very cool. I got Ed Chen on the Capital Razor Show, man. Welcome. How are you doing?
Doing great. It's a pleasure to be here, Ruben.
Oh, dude, this is going to be so much fun, dude. Capital Razor Show Season 3 brought to you by Pitch Decks, my new sponsors. I'm really excited to talk to you, man. You're always a very interesting, high-energy conversation. Love being in breakout rooms with you and Brian Briscoe's TGIF Friday meetings, which you guys should check out if you guys are not a part of that, man. It's free. There's nothing for sale. It's just networking. Really cool. So for the audience that doesn't know Edmund Chen, Ed, tell us a little bit about your background in capital raising, managing family office money, and how you got into this business.
So I have about 20 years experience investing in real estate. And when I started out, like everybody else, I started by reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad when it originally was released and got super excited, wanted to get into real estate, wanted to get into multifamily. And I was about to buy my first deal and I was really nervous about maybe making a couple of mistakes. So I ended up coming across an investment club at the time. They've been investing in real estate in Dallas, Fort Worth, for Dallas, Texas for about 10 years. This is a great place. This is a great group to sort of get to know and see if I can work for them.
Who is the group that you're talking about?
They're gone now, so I don't mention it, but they've okay. All broken up and gone their separate ways. But it was a private equity firm. And what we ended up doing was I kind of made my way in there and we started to grow and they wanted to raise capital. They wanted to really supercharge their capital raising because how they got big was buying a whole bunch of failed savings and loan deals back in the 90s from Texas. And they got a client base, but they wanted to start active prospecting and they needed people to come in to do that. So I was one of those hires to come and do that. And as I started to help build that firm, it eventually became the top third of the firm became multifamily family office. So a lot of wealthy families. And I became a senior advisor after about 10 years and worked with them for a while. And then I ended up becoming a licensed stockbroker. I was a licensed stockbroker while there as well, but then went kind of backwards and I ended up going into the ivory towers of finance. And I became a full on, in Canada, we call it Bay Street. It's our Wall Street, but came like a full legit stockbroker. Also had a life license. So all said and told, I've probably got about 15 years worth of licensed advisory work, much of it for high net worth or pretty much all of it for high net worth in family office.
So number one, we should mention that you're in Canada, which is really cool. I'm curious about what it's like to work with American investors from over there. I would think that the majority of your investors are in the United States, not America, because Canada is America and so is Mexico. I'm very curious about what is it like to work with from Canada with United States citizen investors? Is there any difference? Would you be doing the same thing if you were in New York or somewhere else in the United States?
So the interesting thing is that the licensed world is incredibly regulated, especially in Canada. So in Toronto, it's like our New York City. So that's where the heart of all the money is managed in the nation. And because of that, in the licensed world, you cannot cross borders. Like if I wanted to go and manage money for Americans, I'd have to get a Series 7, have to be sponsored by a U.S. firm. All that is a big headache. So nobody does it. So it's illegal in the licensed world for anybody on Wall Street to call it somebody in Toronto or call somebody in Canada and vice versa. Wow. So I spent all my entire professional career managing money for high net worth Canadian families and some prominent families that I can't even still mention. But then I understand okay. The market. Our assets were in the U.S. and I understand it's very similar. So because culture is very, very close from Canadian culture is heavily influenced by American culture. So you understand you know what's going on in New York, what's going on in Texas, what's going on in California, some of the big pockets of wealth in America.
Fascinating. Okay, so tell me about the licensing. So this might be a two-part thing, right? So do you know about the licensing that you need in the United States and how it is different in Canada for working with the two different demographics of high net worth family offices? They're called family offices in Canada too, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So the best thing to do is in the real estate space in Canada, we call it an EMD, exempt market dealer, meaning they're exempt securities, meaning that you don't have to get a stockbroker's license to promote it. We still use the accredited investor metrics as well. And you do have to get registered as an EMD. So you have to take a licensing to be an EMD and you have to work for an EMD firm. In the US, it's a little, as far as I understand, I'm not a lawyer, so big caveat, I'm not a lawyer, but as far as I understand the regulations in the real estate syndication world, it's 506B, 506C. As long as you're 506C and your investor is accredited and you've satisfied, you know, basic minimum requirements to prove that you've determined that they are some form of accredited investor, then you're sort of okay. It's not really worth it to go get Series 7 to be licensed by a firm because there's very few firms that are going to register you that allow you to do it as a side hustle. You've really got to become a New York stockbroker RIA and take a full charge at it.
Ooh, that's an interesting one. So I don't think that a lot of the audience has been exposed to or knows about RIAs. Can you explain what that is?
In Canada, we just call it investment advisors. That's a licensed term. In the US, I believe it's called registered investment advisors. It's a RIA. And basically what that allows you to do is it now allows you to talk about stocks, pretty much all the investment products that are available out there. So in Canada, the regulations are that if you're an EMD, exempt market dealer, and you're pitching real estate security, that's all you can talk about. I cannot, if my client asks me, hey, should I invest in Apple stock or should I invest in your real estate deal? I cannot make that comparison because I'm not licensed to analyze and give advice on the pros and cons of Apple. If you become a licensed stockbroker, I can now make the comparison.
Okay, cool. So before the show, we mentioned that the avatar of the Capital Raiser show is the aspiring or scaling multifamily and or commercial real estate syndicator. And you may have a unique twist or perception about this particular question that I'm going to ask you, which is, do you think it makes sense to get a license in order to raise capital, or how does that pertain to you and what you do?
It's a cost-benefit analysis. So if you want to get a license, get registered, take a Series 7 and find a firm that'll sponsor you, just so that you can make that small comparison, to me, I don't think it's worth it because the ask is going to be much higher. The requirements that you have to satisfy of being licensed is going to be much higher because you're now subject to a branch manager. You're subject to compliance. You can't advertise in certain things without compliance approving it. It really restricts you. So the benefit is probably not worth the cost unless you want to make this a full-time career. Like when I was a licensed stockbroker, I was living like 60 hours a week. It becomes like a full-time, all-encompassing job because anywhere you are right now, there's a market that's open. Markets are open 24/7. So if you're not watching the Dow Jones, you're watching like foreign markets and you're watching market open and you're watching futures and all this stuff. And you can just, it's like burning the candle at both ends. You got to raise capital at the same time managing the money that you have. And I was managing, you know, a $70 million book of business. So you got to manage that. And sometimes it's in public assets, plus you put it into private assets. Then you also got to bring in anywhere from 15 to 10 to 15 million a year. That's the requirement in order to be part of the firm. So it's a big ask and it's all encompassing. So unless you want that kind of life, and if this is your side hustle, that's not the thing to do right now.
So for my wholesalers out there or single family investors, I kind of want to relate it to this. So as a wholesaler, you don't need a real estate broker's license in order to wholesale. And I think as a capital raiser, it's very similar. You don't specifically need a license in order to raise capital unless you are planning to walk away from the deal. I think the Securities Exchange Commission, their kind of regulation is this. If you want to raise capital, you have to be a partner in the deal, specifically talking about co-GPs or partners. If you want to raise capital, you have to have some kind of ongoing duty within the syndication and or joint venture for the duration of that entire project without walking away with the commission and just saying, goodbye, I'll see you later. You have to have this ongoing duty in order to stay very compliant. Unless, another twist on it is, you can also do this very effectively by becoming a fund manager, go out and create your own fund, which creates a whole nother kind of can of worms where you have to go and talk to a syndication attorney and create your own security and then ask for an exemption so that you can not be regulated the same way that a Coca-Cola or a stock is. But it's kind of an interesting play, or actually there's multiple plays. So you can get licensed, you can start a fund, you can co-GP, or you can partner in some other way, but you can't typically just get a commission and walk off without being a licensed person. So I'm kind of curious about this, man. Let's kind of go into real estate itself as it pertains to you. Are you an investor or are you an advisor? Are you both? Tell me about what you do or what you have done.
Now I have all my licenses down. So I don't hold any licenses anymore. I'm technically not a pro. My wife is still licensed as a stockbroker. So I still have to be careful. I still have to act like a semi-pro, but we still do invest in real estate. I'm the real estate focused guy. My wife does more of the stock picking. Her and her boss are very good at that. They're more quantitative analysis. I'm more of a value investor guy. So value investor skews more to things like real estate. A lot of pension plan style management you'll find follows a lot more like value investing versus quantitative analysis. So that's more my style. Many different styles of how to manage money. But yes, that's kind of what I focus in on now. My main thing is like I manage our own family wealth now. So I've got amassed enough knowledge where it's, you know what, that's exactly what I intended to do when I started out, is become legit and not be insecure about my knowledge. And after 15, 20 years, like, I kind of feel I got there. So let's just, you know, I think I can leave the industry. And as a result of that, I can talk to pretty much anybody I want to now. So I'm not subject to compliance, but I don't manage any money. I don't manage family office money. I'm not looking for investment clients. I cannot give investment advice, especially because of the fact that I'm a former registrant.
Interesting. Okay. And then when it comes to raising capital, you threw that term around. So what does that look like for you, or what has it looked like for you in the past?
So I don't raise capital now. What I can do in terms of licensing is I can teach other people how to all the stuff that I know. So how I fit in the market now is because I'm a former registrant, I know how it's done. And I used to be I was headed towards branch management. So I was identified for that stream. I just looked at all my friends that are branch managers now, and they all hate their lives because they spend so much time in compliance meetings and all this type of stuff. And they just want to mentor people like I did. So that's kind of what I do now. And I coach people, and I perform much like fractional director of sales or fractional branch manager, to show you this is what happens in the licensed investment world. This is how we mentor people. This is how we work with new people. Like typically the best practice is a branch manager would take on anywhere from 7 to 10 new advisors a year and mentor those rookies. And like, what's in your book? What's in your contact list? How can we help you raise? And where are you looking? And as a result, the whole firm gets bigger. So I kind of do that function for other people. It's like, hey, you can hire me as if you went and you got into a licensed Wall Street brokerage firm. I'll show you how they mentor and train new advisors, because I used to do that. So I don't raise capital now, but I did do it before. The reason why I can teach it is because I spent a good 10 years doing it myself.
Raising capital for family offices or raising from family offices?
Raising capital for our private equity firm that dealt a lot with real estate, and doing it through accredited investors all the way up to family office. So to pitch it to family office and everything in between.
Oh, so you were essentially raising capital from these ultra high net worth people for your broker. Is that correct?
For our private equity firm.
So yours, like you were a part owner of that, or you were employed by
yes.
them?
Yeah, I was both employed. And then later on, I started getting a piece of the rock. So I was also an equity owner of the firm itself and a senior partner.
Nice.
That's like a 10 year time frame.
Okay, cool. So when you come across, because I see you in Brian Briscoe's networking events, you're talking to a lot of syndicators and aspiring multifamily capital raisers and whatnot, and you're talking about your coaching business at least some of the time, right? So when you take on a coaching client that's scaling multifamily syndicator / potentially capital raiser, what kind of stuff do you offer them in your coaching business?
The way that I work is highly customized to the individual, because it's a best practice from the finance world that I came from. Each person has a unique skill set and a unique experience, and their avatar or their ideal clients are also a unique avatar. So it's not one mold will fit everything. So in my view, it's like when you get to the high level, it starts getting into, okay, what do you have on offer? And based on who you are, how is that valuable to your avatar? What is your avatar's pain point? Because there's millionaires are not made the same. A millennial millionaire versus an X-gen millionaire versus a baby boomer millionaire will resonate different based on what you have in your tool chest. And it's identifying those things. It's like, hey, okay, so you know, you're a millennial and your avatar, your ideal client is a X-gen in this demographic. Well, based on that, this is what your hurdles are. These are what your challenges are going to be. These are going to be their objections, but these are their pain points and how you can fill them. And that takes unique understanding of both pieces and a lot of experience in the industry. It's like, I know what they're going to say because they used to say it to me, or they'll tell me different things. I spent over 2 decades. If you listen to Malcolm Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours or 10 years as professional competence. Well, I got about 20,000 hours. I got twice that. It's instinctive for me now.
And then, so do any of the clients that you take on, are they looking for limited partner capital? Or are they specifically looking for institutional and family office capital?
Right now, a lot of the clients that I'm picking up want to level up their skill at the accredited investor level, but I do plot out that road to get to family office and institutional because it's a stepping stone to get there. So as Stephen Covey says in Seven Habits, begin with the end in mind. So my real intent is to help people move their needle wherever you are. So awesome. If you only have success at newly accredited, I want to show you the $5 million or $3 million space. If you're great at the $3 million and $10 million, now you're starting to get into family office. I'll show you how to get that $10 million, because a $10 million should start having some family office sort of a feel to it. And if it doesn't, that's how you can get your way in there. And then so further informed. Where my skills probably level off is at a single family office, like the 100 or 200 million. I probably won't be qualified to give you advice on how to close the Hiltons or the Rockefellers. That's a massive family office. Or Bain Capital, right? That's a huge family office.
Okay, so talk to me about this particular moment of history where your client or just in general, a multifamily syndicator has said to themselves, and I know a lot of people like this, including Joseph Bramante, they're like, hey, I can either go and raise from like 100 or maybe even more, depending on what kind of exemption you use, limited partners, or I could just get like a single check or maybe a couple of check writers to fund the entire thing. Like from your perspective, when does it make sense to use a single source of income versus multiple tens of limited partners to raise capital?
It's a very good question. I'm glad that you asked this because not too many people understand this nuance. There's a sweet spot. And if you get a single check, so if I had a family office client and they said, hey, Ed, we want to write you a $10 million check for one deal. You have to understand that you are going to become a slave to that family office. You might as well be part of that family office. So in every single family office, it's a family. So go to somebody else's family on Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas, and that's what it's going to feel like. But you're not part of the family, and maybe you're an invited guest, but there's going to be some sort of dysfunction that's going on in it. Every family's like that. And usually when you add a large amount of wealth, it doesn't make it better. It just makes it more complex. So you're part of it. And if they write you a $10 million check, you're part friend, part slave, or part servant to that family. And if they write a $10 million check, if they call you at 3 a.m., you have to answer on the other side. So that's why we don't necessarily want one check from one large family, because they're going to steer the whole operation and they're going to take over your life. Now, the other side of it is this sweet spot on the other range is you don't want to have a $10,000 clients. It's way too much. It's way too labor intensive. You just have way too many clients to talk to. If you want to go and disseminate information and you want to do it, it's not right to have clients and just do a blast email. Because if they have $10,000 invested with you and they're just barely accredited and you just send them, hey, here's your email, and it's some generic email, mass email, it doesn't really go well. It could go over very well, especially in this range, in this sort of accredited investor space. The ideal that you want is a little mix of both. It's good to have a couple of high-end clients that will feed you some big checks to really keep things going, but also have some smaller clients. So a nice range. When we buy and sell books of business, this is how RIAs work. We buy and sell books. It's not just on the AUM. There's many different metrics. If somebody says, hey, I'm retiring from the industry. Do you want to buy my book of business? It's $100 million. Nobody gets excited just yet. When it's like, sure, $100 million is nothing to sneeze at. How many clients do you have? If the person says, I have a $100 million book of business, do you want to buy it? Oh, there's 6,000 clients. That is a horrible book of business. No thanks. It's far too much. Just to introduce myself, you know how long it's going to take me to call 6,000 clients? Forget it. Way too small. But if they say that, oh, I have a $100 million book of business, it's two clients. It's like, forget it. I don't want that book of business. Because what happens if I talk to one client and the Hiltons hate me and they just leave? There goes half the book of business. I'm not going to pay you for that. Like a nice sweet number. If it's like $100 million, if they said that, oh, it's about 100 clients. So there's a couple of $10 million clients, but then there's a couple of people that I'm just bringing in. They're accredited, but they only have like half a million with us. That's a sort of a sweet spot. That's a really good book of business with some big high-end clients, but it's not completely high-end clients or too big, but not too small either. A nice sort of mix. That's a good book.
Okay, so here's a couple of things that I've heard, because I have not yet worked with a family office. But just from the show, I want to throw out a couple of potential myths or misconceptions that you can verify and or deny based off of your experience of working closely with ultra high net worth family offices and people in that kind of space. So number one, if you are going into a syndication with the plan to raise from family offices, you may decide that it doesn't make sense to write syndication docs. Because as soon as you take those docs to family office, they're going to rip those papers up and rewrite it. And you just have wasted a bunch of money with syndication attorneys because they want to have control. They want to have the ability to kick you out. And they're going to want a very high level of discretion and ability to review your particular paperwork, documents, reporting at such a high level that it's different than what you may be used to and accustomed to giving to your limited partners, like the family offices and the high net worth and the these kind of guys that write you a single check. They want a level of control that's much higher and a level of reporting that's much higher. And it may or may not make sense for you to want to do that based off of how good you are at communicating and reporting. And the other part is that, like, some of these big check writers, if you're not very careful, they can walk away from the deal. Like, let's say somebody says, hey, you know, like, I like your business model. We're going to go ahead and commit $10 million to this project. And then 10 days before closing, they're like, you know what? I'm just going to go with these other guys because they're more lucrative than what you're offering, and they leave you hanging. So what the syndicator and or investor sponsor has to do in order to mitigate that risk is require that these guys put in some earnest money deposit or something that's going to kind of prevent them from just splitting at the end. Is this your experience so far? Tell me if some of this stuff is true or not true.
I would agree. The biggest thing is being unequally balanced. So finding a client that is equally balanced with your size, and don't get too starry-eyed if it's massive. Walk away. It's important to walk away and understand where your limit is. Because a lot of the times you talked about the sort of the accurate things where if you're new and starting out, there are nefarious groups that look for that. And they try to get you to do things that get onto the line, if not cross the line. So for an example, it's like, say somebody comes in, they threaten to give you a $10 million check. And he's like, yeah, that's amazing. And say, absolutely, go out and buy that Ferrari, go and buy that massive mansion, go get married and all this type of stuff, and then lock you in. And then at the last minute, then they put on all these conditions on that $10 million so that if you back it out, it's going to be massive. It's almost impossible for you not to accept that comp or a commission. So they can end up pushing you onto that line and say, oh, by the way, one last thing, you got to help me bury this dead body. And then next thing you know, you're in a John Grisham, the firm, where you realize that family office is actually the mob. And they get you to do something illegal to tie you into it. And next, you're in the middle of Godfather.
Wow.
Right? So you gotta be really careful with stuff like that. To get unequally balanced. Like I had somebody in one of these networks, they're calling out and they say, hey, I have a very high net worth client that's asking me to help them find $20 million to place in real estate on a 1031 exchange. And they need to do it real fast. They have 60 days left to put 20 million and they're asking me to help find it for them. So I sat down, I talked to the guy. He's like, how many capital raises have you done so far? And it's like, this will be my first one. And I told him, walk away. I'm like, what do you mean? It's like, don't get as excited as you think it is. It's like, why? It's like, because the due diligence that you're going to have to do it, there's probably $1 million worth of lawyers on the other side. And they're going to send you so many docs that in order to be balanced, you need to spend about $1 million in legal just to be able to balance that out. But unless I have it wrong, I don't think you have $1 million of legal retainer, do you? And then he's like, I don't, because they could slip in so many things that you have no idea what's going on. You are fully balanced. You won't be able to take that down. I see nothing but danger there. Walk away. Start small. Be appropriate for the size that you're going for. Don't get super excited and bend over backwards. If the family office comes to you and says, I got a $20 million check. Will you raise it? And this is your third raise. And the most you've ever raised was $750,000. You know, danger, Will Robinson. There's something not right there. I even asked them, it's like a 20 million, let's look at the other side. If I had a $20 million 1031 exchange, I could probably walk into any brokerage firm on Wall Street and get attention. Why are they going to this person that's never raised capital before?
So the aspiring capital raiser that's very interested in not going through this building of a limited partner database and kind of prefers the concept of, hey, let me just be a really good reporter and work with some family office, even though I'm kind of signing my life away to some extent and the ability for them to kick me out if I misperform. They may go into their syndications and real estate operations with this in mind. But what kind of happened to George Abreu, at least if I recall correctly from the story that he told me, is like he thinks that he's talking to some family offices and institutions. And reality, he's not. He's talking to a gatekeeper that has access to the money, and they take some of his money to give him access to it. But he thinks he's talking to the money and he's not. And then at the end of the day, he gets ripped off. Tell me, is this a common occurrence? Tell me about your experiences here.
100%. I've seen this. So you got to watch it in the docs. And because of the private equity network, there's a lot of bid asks. So people asking us like, hey, Ed, I got somebody who's looking to buy this, or I got looking for somebody who wants to sell this. Do you have anybody else? And it's like playing goldfish. So you've got to recognize when it gets a little further and you start making connections, I started realizing it's pretty easy to get cut out of the deal. People can go around you all the time. So how do you figure out a way where you're part of it? Well, for me, the way I figured out how to be a part of it is to become part of the firm. So the part of the firm that's making the offering. So I'm at least on one side or the other. That's one way. But yes, that does happen, especially if there's a whole bunch of people, a whole bunch of quote unquote brokers making connections. If there's five people in the middle between buyer and seller, somebody's going to get cut out of the deal, especially if it's a big one. It could certainly happen quite a lot. So you do have to be careful about that. That's a legitimate concern for sure.
That's fantastic. All right. So let's kind of go back into your coaching. So you take somebody that wants to work with family offices and get them to the next level. What kind of stuff are you teaching them along the way?
The first thing is that if you want to level up, you got to level up on your skill set and take a look at. So Sun Tzu, The Art of War, has this concept, which is know yourself, know your enemy or know your opponent and know the battlefield. In modern business, especially in terms of capital raising, is know yourself. What do you have on offer? What's your skill set? Be realistic about what your skills are and what level you're at. And then who else are you up against? What else does, and the battlefield or the terrain is your clients, is the family office. What are they expecting? When they go up and they talk to advisors and they talk to the people that they listen to and they respect, when you enter the room, do you sound like that? Are you on par with that? So if you're going to the country club and all the people that family office are being advised by, pay attention to their advisors. And if you come in and you don't look like them and you don't sound like them, chances are you're not going to be able to establish rapport easily, if at all.
Okay, so I want to bring this up, man. I was recently at a family office club event in Newport Beach, and I came across an institution that wanted to stroke a $20 million check. And it was just kind of just probing to see, like, where am I? How much money do I need? And I told them, like, we probably do like $6 or $7 million raises for our built to rent projects. And maybe like within the next year or two, we'll need about $20 million altogether. And he kind of, I think he was just kind of playing with me, just kind of checking to see where I was, to see if I would be a candidate. And I think I clearly was disqualified before he really even started talking to me. But he kind of tried to break down this concept for me that I'd like to see if you can relate with this and see if there's some validity to what he said to me. He gave me this metaphor of McDonald's as they're going into a new market. They do all this demographic and market research. And when they set up shop, Burger King, without doing any research whatsoever, sets up a restaurant right across the street from them. And he said family offices and institutions are very similar to the Burger King, where if they see a syndicator that has worked with a family office previously, they know that some family office has done a great deal of due diligence on you. And if you pass the test to get in with a family office, then it's kind of like the floodgates open and all these other Burger King family offices come want to invest with you. Is there any truth to this metaphor?
Yeah, I would say that that's true. Because the way that it would work is there's a number of ways to sort of go over that and combat that. Yes, it's family offices, especially the smaller ones, they want to be efficient. So they don't want to dump all this effort into market research and learning new things. They'd like somebody else to try it first. Like their venture into Bitcoin or crypto, for an example, they won't be the leading indicators of that. They won't be the leading investors out of that. They will sit and watch to see how it goes first. Family offices by nature are more like my style, which is value investing, more conservative. The reason being is that most high net worth individuals or high net worth families, the more money you amass, the more that the mentality or the core philosophy of the asset or the management is less growth and more principal preservation. So my specialty in family office management, or the way that I brought them on, was principal preservation. And the term that we use is, my first thing, like, Mr. Jones, my first thing is return of your capital, not return on capital. That's where I start. And then I look for risk-adjusted returns. And the place that, if you don't have a family office manager that focuses on tax, because you're high net worth, your biggest loss, I'll tell you right now, is tax. Tax will be the biggest expense anybody has in life. And family offices understand this to the core. So a tax savings or tax management is a significant component of family office management. If you start saying talk like that, you start getting in closer and closer into the club. So I start off with tax is my main focus, then return of your capital, not return on capital. And once I can satisfy those two, then I move out from there. That's sort of the mentality that you'll find in the family office space.
Okay, good stuff. So that being said, how do you get somebody that's a syndicator, assuming that they have a track record, let's say 1,000 units, whether that's multifamily or development or whatever, but they have a track record, they've never invested with multifamily. How do you take them from getting their money from limited partners to getting their money from family office based off of what do you coach them to do in order to penetrate that space?
There's a really good Zig Ziglar line, which is you can have everything you want in life if you help just enough other people get what they want in life. And that's one of the core things that I teach people as a like sort of the fundamental characteristic when it comes to capital raising and across the entire spectrum. And it requires a skill, a deep skill of empathy, which is understanding what the world is like from somebody else's perspective. I don't care if you're a newly accredited or a multi-billionaire. You want something in life. You need something in life. So instead of going and pitching what you're trying to sell, try to show that you understand. If you can go in and empathize with that person without having to ask and know what their pain points are and be able to speak to those pain points and then show them how you have a solution from them, you get people's attention real fast.
So do you break down the pain points of the family offices specifically one by one? Or do you say, hey, this is the pain point of the majority of family offices?
It's more nuanced than that because every single family office is going to be unique, right? Just like every single family. Now, there are some potential similarities, and I'll tell you some examples of some similarities. If you're dealing with a 70-year-old patriarch of a family office, he's the one at the helm. He's got 2 to 3 kids, adult kids in their 40s and a bunch of grandkids. Usually what I start off, if I don't know enough, well, my default starting place is succession. Is how do you overcome shirt sleeve to shirt sleeves, which is a term in family office. It's almost a cliche in family office, which is your family office will shut down and fail. 90% of family offices fail after the third generation. So your grandkids will squander all the effort. So that's usually the biggest concern at that point is how do I look after my family and my grandkids without spoiling them? And coming up with solutions like that, that's usually my default. And then I'll adjust based on responses I get. But each family is going to be slightly different.
I've heard that numerous times, actually, that the first generation of wealth is the creator, the second generation grows it, and then the third generation loses it. So what are some of the tricks or the things that families or people in general can do to make sure that their third generation keeps and grows and preserves that wealth?
One of the things that I start off with is I tell people is like, well, okay, if I was pitching them, I said, well, my specialty is helping my families, the families that I serve, become the 10% of survive past the third generation. And one of the biggest things that I see is a family constitution. Do you have a family constitution that's been written? And a family constitution, like on the individual level, it's more like an investor policy statement. This is my beliefs. This is what I want to invest in. When you get to a larger family office, it turns into a family constitution. A family constitution is basically what do you want to write to your grandkids? Because right now they're like 13 or 12 and they don't get it. They don't understand it. But eventually you're going to be gone. When they're old enough to understand it, you're going to be gone and you won't be able to tell them. So put it down on paper. Tell them the blood, sweat, and tears, what you represent, what are your values, what you had to do in order to write your own Think and Grow Rich or Richest Man in Babylon. How did you make this money? When your grandkids get to the age where they're starting to benefit from the trust and they're getting into their 20s and 30s, one of the stipulations you can have is on an annual basis, you've got to review the family constitution or our family constitution. And it's words from granddad. This is how we made our money. When I started and I was dirt poor and how hard it was for me to make this. So you get a deeper appreciation for the benefit that you're now reaping.
Fascinating. That's so cool. All right, man, let's jump into the lightning round. The first question I have for you is, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Best vacation I've ever taken was my honeymoon, and that was in Hawaii. I love Hawaii.
Nice. What's your favorite book of any kind?
If I had to pick one book, one business book, it would be How to Win Friends and Influence People. Biggest influence in my sales career. There's a lot of other ones that are very close. If it's outside book all of all time, of course, it's the book, which is Scripture.
Okay, cool. Favorite childhood memory?
I guess it would be with my grandfather, my paternal grandfather. He was an insurance guy. So he was in finance and it skipped a generation and I brought it back into finance. Interesting side note of why that's important to me. My last name in Chinese is literally money. So the character for money is our last. And our ancestors were financial professionals. So my grandfather was a financial professional and so am I. Nobody else in our family. So we have that connection.
Wow, that's really cool. Can you share any real estate war stories?
Absolutely. My biggest war story is a massive story, which is in 2008, I was managing money at the time. I lost about $35 million for clients over the course of a couple of weeks. And I was a young advisor at the time, and it was just chaos. It was chaos everywhere, left, right, and center. probably the most stress I've ever gone through in my life. I never thought I'd be able to see 35 million or manage 35 million, let alone lose 35 million in the course of a couple of weeks.
So what was the ramification of that? I'm surprised like somebody didn't want to murder you.
The top two worst client responses I got, the top two were death threats, literally death threats.
Wow.
And of course, I'm not the only one. Yeah, I'm not the only one. A lot of other people were going through the same stuff. So it was a really tough time. That's where I really cut my chops, because the biggest benefit for that of how I made it through, my lesson that I learned is mentorship. The way I made it through 2008 was the people that were mentoring me, the senior advisors, told us, this is what we went through in the dot-com bubble burst, and this is what we went through in Black Monday in the 80s. So they've gone through two of them. It's like, this is how we made it through, and you're gonna make it through too. So it's important to have that kind of mentorship, especially when you hit those downturns or you hit those really, really bad, stressful times.
Damn,
because
they
will happen.
That's crazy. All right, do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
So one of the biggest things I do is try to temper that off. And when you're having good days, you gotta write a gratitude journal. Because what limiting beliefs are, it is negativity bias, where you hyper-focus on one negative point and you forget nine of the positive things. And the way that you remind yourself is to bring that back into balance through a gratitude journal. Very important teaching.
Love that. How long do you want to live?
I don't really look at that point. I just want to serve as long as I can. So I don't want to live forever, but I'd love to serve as long as I can. So I don't think about how long to live.
Put a number on it.
I would rather live well than live long.
Put a number on it.
I don't know, let's just say 80.
Okay, cool. Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
I think so, yes. Something that I teach is maturities. So being a spiritually mature talks about ethics and values. I think that's incredibly important. People can see that. You can't hide those types of things, especially when you get to high-level family office. They watch, and they watch you very carefully. So it's not something that you can act or pretend. You've got to believe it to the core. And when you do that, you tend to rise to the top eventually.
Okay, so I want to hear about this hobby that you have with painting with airbrushes.
So that's one of the things that I really enjoy. It's my background, interestingly enough, is not in finance. So I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in theater. So I'm a fine artist, and I'm a right brain creative thinker. And it took me a long while for me to bring that out into finance, because I had a branch manager that asked me, and he said, you know what, Ed, it's like you connect so fast with people and you're so different than the other advisors. I don't understand why. And he kept digging until he looked into my resume. He's like, oh, it's because you have a Bachelor of Fine Arts. It's because you're an artist. One of the benefits is because I'm balanced between right and left brain thinking. So when you paint with an airbrush, one of the things I try to do is try to make realistic recreations of realistic things. And when you try to do that, it gets your mind to think and problem solve, but also do it in a creative way, which is exactly the same thing you do in capital raising. It's the same skill, it's cross training. It strengthens your neural pathways to analyze certain things from a different perspective that other people can't see, and doing it in a creative way. And it's exercising those same neural pathways. So that's why I really enjoy it.
Fascinating. That's a very interesting mix. I actually have a degree in chemistry and a degree. Yeah, I studied multiple languages. When you study languages in college, it's not just the actual understanding of the language. It's like typically, like for example, English, you're studying Hamlet, or Spanish, you're studying the literature of the conquest of Mexico or whatever. So those are completely different sides of the brain that you need to use, one for chemistry, one for fine arts and language and the dissection of poetry and whatnot. So very fascinating to know that about you. There's not many of us out there like that. Let me ask you this question. What's the best way to raise capital from your perspective? Short answer on this.
Best way to raise capital is be empathetic. Care more about other people and understanding what they need. Be a servant, be a great servant. It's not shameful to be a great servant. It's honorable to serve people well.
Beautiful. All right, two more questions. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience?
I think a miracle is for a fine artist to become like a full-on registered investment advisor stockbroker. I think that's a miracle on its own.
For
sure. I never imagined I could do that.
I love it. Okay, so last question asked to you by Shannon Amigo, one of our great listeners. She would like to know, what impact would you like to leave in the world?
I think the biggest impact is being able to change people's lives for the better, and have people say that, you know, if it wasn't for Ed and, you know, what he did for me, my life would have taken a much different path. I think that's really important to me, is helping people become the better versions of themselves.
I dig it. Very fun part of the show. Thanks for entertaining us on that. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation, to my company Legacy Acquisition, and our sponsors, Good Egg Investment, Syndication Pro, Apartment Educators, The Family Office Club, and PitchDecks.com. Check out all of their offerings at capitalraisershow.com. Ed, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
The best way to get a hold of me is through LinkedIn. Use my name, Edmund Chen, E-D-M-U-N-D-C-H-I-E-N. And then you can find me on LinkedIn. Feel free to drop me a message.
All right, last question. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser and or multifamily syndicator as they scale on their journey?
Biggest thing is just keep doing it. Consistency is the key. Consistency over long periods of time. Don't give up and find good mentorship.
Yes. Those are great points, man. Love this, dude. This has been a lot of fun, man. Thank you for bringing your wisdom and everything that you, your experiences are just completely different than the majority of the people that I had on the show, man. So this has been a ton of fun. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day, my friend.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.